Hello, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host for today, Aidan Brown. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics in hopes of making legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide legal information while always being entertaining. Today's show will be a discussion of contemporary issues as they relate to the Canadian legal system in the realm of emerging technologies, specifically relating to data privacy, cybersecurity, and torts we all know and, of course, have loved from our torts class in law school, especially focusing upon intrusion upon seclusion in Jones and CE. Before we begin the show, we would like to note that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, the host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of Pro Bono Students Canada, Queen's Law Chapter, student volunteers. Pro Bono students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains a general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Technology continues to advance with ever-increasing speed, and along with it, so too does the accompanying danger of cybersecurity risks in an increasingly digitized world. While in many ways our legal system has begun to engage with both new technologies and cybersecurity risks, I find that as a law student, information encompassing these topics is often scarce at the school level. Considering how fascinating this topic is, this episode will aim to provide you with an accessible and candid discussion on the intersection of emerging technologies, data privacy, and the Canadian legal system. Privacy, especially in the realm of online data that is exchanged countless times per day between individuals and organizations and data brokers online, is a fundamental underlying principle and right that requires protection in the legal system. Especially today, considering our reliance on online services that we knowingly or unknowingly provide our data to, it's incredibly important to understand the recourse that one may have when privacy issues come to the fore. These issues can take all different shapes and sizes, and one may not even realize that their privacy has been compromised, which is why it's important to raise awareness of the recourse that is available to people when their privacy rights are breached. The fundamental aspect of privacy rights that people should know about and should take note of is when we give our data to these companies or data brokers or anyone in day-to-day interactions that may seem trivial in the moment, that information can be accessed by a whole host of actors that we may not know anything about. And I think this was clearly shown where an example of where this sort of went wrong in the case of Jones and Sigi, which was an Ontario Court of Appeal case, which involved an individual whose information that they thought was private, that they had given to the bank in doing something as trivial as signing up for a bank account and using their debit card, turned out not to be private. It was accessed multiple times by someone that was doing so in a manner that was not okay and not consistent with the relevant legal principles protecting data privacy. So this is an important foundational case in the recourse that is available to individuals that suffer these issues. Jones was a fairly monumental case in which the Ontario Court of Appeal first ended up recognizing the tort of intrusion upon seclusion. And that tort is essentially described by a phrase from the case that says, one who intentionally intrudes, physically or otherwise, upon the seclusion of another or his private affairs or concerns is subject to liability to the other for invasion of his privacy, if that invasion would be considered highly offensive to a reasonable person. This is a case with a highly fascinating set of facts that speak to the point made earlier, where when you give up your information to organizations, whether they be a bank like the case in Jones or any other organization really, you may not know who is accessing that information behind the scenes. And it's important to be aware of any recourse available to you if you discover that your information is being accessed improperly. And that's exactly what happened here in this case. Essentially, what happened is Jones and Sagi both worked at different branches of the same bank. They didn't know each other, and they didn't work together. Jones maintained her primary bank account at the same bank which she worked at. Now, Sagi became involved in a relationship with Jones's former husband for several years. As a result of this, Sagi used her workplace computer to access Jones's personal bank accounts 174 times. The information she had was details of transactions, what she was spending her money on, and personal information like her date of birth, marital status, address, etc. Now, Sagi didn't publish or distribute or record the information in any way, but nonetheless accessed the information a multitude of times improperly. She was not authorized to do so and did so because of the nature of the relationship that Jones had with her ex-husband. Now, of course, Jones wasn't initially aware that her bank account was being accessed by Sagi for these purposes, but she eventually became suspicious and complained to the bank, and the bank ended up confronting Sagi and confirming that she had improperly accessed Jones's information at least 174 times. She knew that it was contrary to the bank's code of business conduct and ethics, and to her professional responsibility as an employee of the bank. Now, Sagi maintained that this was all because of a financial dispute with her former husband that Jones was seeing, and only looked at the accounts to confirm whether he was actually paying his child support, which is, of course, not a proper reason to be accessing her accounts. So, as one would, Jones ended up bringing an action against Sagi for a breach of privacy. Now, this tort of intrusion upon seclusion had never been recognized, judicially at least, in Ontario. So the initial trial judge granted a summary judgment and dismissed the claim for damages that Jones had brought because of the fact that no tort in this area was recognized. It did end up being appealed to the Court of Appeal in Ontario, which ended up allowing the appeal and recognizing the cause of action that is now known as intrusion upon seclusion. As we learn as first years in law school, it is certainly within the capacity of the common law, and it is one of the advantages, some would argue, of the common law, that it has an ability to evolve and respond to problems like this that are posed by the routine collection and aggregation of highly personal information that is readily accessible in electronic form. That was the case here. This information of what Jones was spending her money on and the personal information that came along with opening a bank account was obviously quite personal. And the fact that there was no remedy for having that information be accessed improperly, as Justice Sharp put it at the Court of Appeal, cried out for a remedy from the common law. And what Justice Sharp ended up doing is exactly what many of us learn to do in law school, which is arguing by analogy. He started at principles that have been existent in tort law for quite some time, like the right to freedom from, quote, trespass. At least in this case, it didn't represent trespass from land, but an invasion of your autonomy or your boundaries. And he went from there and moved on to a general right to privacy about private matters. Otherwise, we can't have a civilized society if nothing at all in people's lives was private. It just is an underlying principle of our society in general. From there, he jumped to the right to privacy about mail, which can include keeping private bank records. Because think about this, reading someone else's mail is an offense, and bank records are used in the mail and are considered personal. Now, granted, bank records are largely mailed electronically via email or through an app of some sort now, but the analogy is still there. And at the time this case was decided in 2012, mailing bank records may have been, and likely was, far more common than it is now. And from there, he finally made the leap to the tort of intrusion upon seclusion. And he drew this tort with reference to Professor Prosser, who is an American scholar that wrote A Concise Restatement of Torts. And although this tort hadn't been previously recognized in Canada, Justice Sharp noted that a right to informational privacy has long been a fundamental value in our law. And the technological change that has come along with everything that's happening in our society has motivated, or at least in Justice Sharp's case, motivated more formal legal protection of an individual's right to privacy now. And that right to privacy here clearly ended up applying to Jones's and Segee's situation. Obviously, this was a case where bank records were improperly accessed, and considering that jump through those old principles to the new principle of an intrusion upon seclusion, Justice Sharp found that the remedy applied directly to this case. And it's fascinating how he was able to develop these arguments and apply them to the case and make this new tort, which is one of the primary ways people can seek recourse for their information being improperly accessed. Now, I think it's worth noting that there are three primary elements to establishing the tort of intrusion upon seclusion. That is, first, that the defendant's conduct must be intentional, within which Justice Sharp said he would have included reckless conduct. Second, the defendant must have invaded, without any lawful justification, the plaintiff's private affairs or concerns. And third, a reasonable person would have to regard that invasion by the defendant as highly offensive, causing distress, humiliation, or anguish. And I think it's worth noting too that Justice Sharp says in this case, proof of harm to simply a recognized economic interest is just not an element of this cause of action. Now, the one thing that I think is controversial about the remedy provided by this tort is the limited compensatory damages that Justice Sharp provided for in his judgment. Now, obviously, this has developed as the jurisprudence has developed through time, but at the time of Jones and Segee, Sharp fixed the range of damages up to only $20,000. Now, that may seem like a lot of money, but pursuing court cases is also quite an expensive endeavor. And it's worth noting that signaling to individuals who invade the privacy of others is, or at least I think, should be an important goal of the court. And whether or not $20,000 is sufficient to achieve that goal is up for debate. I think imposing that hard limit was probably a mistake, but it also makes sense in hindsight, as this was a brand new tort, and I'm sure Justice Sharp wasn't interested in potentially doing what he viewed would be overstepping his authority. And he did give rationale for this. He said that the intangible nature of the interest being protected here means that the damages for the tort should be measured by a modest conventional sum, which he viewed as being capped at $20,000. He did give a couple factors, for example, from the Manitoba Privacy Act, providing guidance for assisting in determining where in the range of $0 to $20,000 a case may fall. But that's not necessary to discuss here. Jones ended up being awarded in this case $10,000, as Justice Sharp viewed the invasion of her privacy to be in the mid-range of that $0 to $20,000 that this tort would protect. Now, like I said, it's up for debate whether that $20,000 limit that Justice Sharp imposed for the tort of intrusion upon seclusion in this case is an appropriate one. And it's food for thought for whoever is listening to this summary of the case. However, it's important to remember and to realize that there are remedies available for breaches of your privacy. And it's important to be cognizant of this because many people may not realize that despite the intangible nature of this tort, as Justice Sharp acknowledged in his case, it is a wrong, and it is a wrong that the law has sought to correct via awarding damages which signal to these wrongdoers that you cannot invade the privacy of others without suffering the consequences. And I think that's an important mission. Whether or not the limit is $20,000, $200,000, $2 million, there has to be some sort of signaling effect at play. And Justice Sharp clearly accomplished that, at the very least, in this case. Now, I think there's further food for thought necessary here with how this tort may be applied to scenarios unlike the situation that came before Justice Sharp. And a good example of that is Oceanic v. Equifax Canada, which is a 2022 case that also reached the Ontario Court of Appeal. In this case, the plaintiffs sought to apply this tort to commercial defendants who collected and stored the personal information of themselves and others, and who failed in protecting this information by allowing hackers to access and use that information that was in their databases by failing to take appropriate safeguards, as the plaintiffs asserted. Now, this case ended up failing at the quote, conduct stage of the tort, as the Court of Appeal said that Equifax's negligent storage of information cannot in law amount to an invasion of or an intrusion upon the plaintiff's privacy interest in that information. The court said that the tort must apply to those who intrude, but cannot extend liability to someone who doesn't intrude, but rather fails to prevent the intrusion of another, as this would be, in the court's opinion, an unwelcome expansion of tort. Now, this would have been, of course, quite a large expansion of the applicability of the tort. It would have applied to any commercial actors where their negligent storage of data ended up resulting in breaches. Now, the companies that would have been subject to this liability argue that the effects on them would have been staggering if they ever suffered a cyber attack. And this is understandable, as this is an understandable position to take, because it certainly would expand the ambit of the tort quite a bit from what it was potentially intended or portrayed to be in Jones and Segee. But whether or not there's an argument to be made about the fact that such an expansion of the tort might serve to convince these companies that store people's data to do so in a secure and non-negligent manner. It's up for debate. I would leave that for with you as well to consider whether you think that expansion of liability would be an appropriate use of this tort and an appropriate signaling effect to not just bad actors that end up intruding upon the private information of others, but also those who fail to prevent these bad actors from being able to intrude upon the private information of others. Like I said, whether or not that is a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. But the court ended up deciding what they decided, and that is the way the law is right now. So while it is important to recognize that there is recourse available to individuals where their privacy has been infringed, it's also important to recognize the limits that the courts have placed upon one's ability to recover from those actors, which plaintiffs may view have either invaded their privacy or allowed a situation to develop where their privacy could be invaded. Now, there are also legislative developments that have been made in this realm in response to sort of this sort of indecision that's been present in the court in whether or not to extend the liability to commercial actors or whether that's even an appropriate thing to do. Bill C-27 is an example that was being studied by the House of Commons and is still being studied by the House of Commons for quite some time. If passed, this bill would create, quote, a statutory cause of action for breaches of a number of proposed substantive obligations, including the protection of personal information. For example, the current draft of the Act proposes a requirement for organizations to implement and maintain a, quote, privacy management program that includes things like the policies, practices, and procedures that that organization has implemented to fulfill the other obligations created under the Act. Those obligations include things like protecting individuals' personal information. Now, in its current form, the Act is a bit vague in defining these obligations. For example, it says that security safeguards must protect personal information against, for example, loss, theft, unauthorized access, disclosure, copying, etc. But it doesn't necessarily stipulate what exactly is the line between an appropriate safeguard and one that is insufficient for protecting people's personal information. So while this act seems like a step in the right direction for providing clarity on decisions that are made encompassing torts like intrusion upon seclusion and the liability and obligations that companies may have in failing to protect people's personal information, we've still got a ways to go. And there's no indication that this may even end up passing the House as it's been sitting in the House of Commons being studied at committee for quite some time. On balance, I hope this discussion of Jones and Segee and the following one of the following cases, clarifying the applicability of that tort and the possibility of the passage of Bill C-27 has made you a little bit more informed on the protections for data privacy that exist in the Canadian legal system, and has hopefully given you some food for thought on how far you think liability should go for those who either fail to protect the personal information of others, or for those who themselves end up invading the personal information of others by improperly accessing data that companies, organizations, or whoever may hold. I think it serves as an important reminder to be cognizant of who you end up giving your data to, because while there is recourse, it certainly can be a challenging hill to climb to bring any type of legal action, much less one that is focused on such a new and emerging area of law like data privacy. Regardless, I thank you for listening and hope that you have enjoyed this discussion. A further reminder that nothing in this podcast constitutes legal advice. We are students, we are not lawyers, and if you need legal advice in the realm of data privacy or any other matter, please consult with a lawyer.